As you know, the Colorado shooting has everyone's attention. News reports are recounting the number of males, young men, who go through and do these kind of things, commit such atrocities. And yet they report that no one knows how to anticipate and prevent such things from happening. And it's a real dilemma in our nation now. How do you anticipate and how do you prevent these type of things? Well, God has a way to deal with it, believe it or not. And take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 21. Deuteronomy chapter 21 and verse 18. Deuteronomy 21 and verse 18. It said here, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son, and it tends to be the sons, I guess it could happen to the ladies too, but it tends to be the sons, I'm afraid. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, now he no longer listens to them, who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them. Then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders of the city, to the gate of his city. And they shall say to the elders of the city, our son is stubborn and rebellious. That's pretty strong. Stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Now, this is a pretty severe problem, right? This is somebody that's really out of control. Then all the men of that city shall stone him to death with stones. You shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Now, that sounds very harsh, does it not? It really sounds harsh. But it's interesting, when they contacted the mother of this shooter, whatever the circumstances were, she was reported to said that she was sure that they had the right guy. In other words, she knew the problem. She knew the difficulties. But our society has no way to deal with it. We have no way to deal with it. But, you know, she thought there's nothing she can do about it. Just sit there in pain and wondering what's going to happen in the long run. And how many families are in that situation where children are out of control? God said that the parents who knew their son was out of control were the ones who were to address the problem. And you deal with it there. Our society tends to send them to college. The shootings are at colleges, or people who are at college. It's amazing. But at college, they have even less supervision than they have at home. Because our society is an honor system, but if you don't have honor, you're in great difficulty and you fall through the cracks. We have no way to deal with it. And they're trying to give the benefit of the doubt, and they're trying to assume everybody's on their own and able to stand on their own, but some are not. So, all of a sudden, these people go off, away from home, away from family, and do outrageous and terrible things. I just thought I'd point that out to you. That we need God to show us how to run a society. And if it seems harsh, what we have recently is also harsh. And it's terrible, and they involve people who had no idea this was going to happen to them. They're just going to have a nice time and be with their family. It's terrible, but that's how we deal with these things in America. We don't deal with them until it's a crisis. And God deals with it when you can see a crisis coming, and you do it ahead of time. I sent everyone on email details on how to participate in the Feast music program. So if anybody didn't get that or if you have any questions, I'd be glad to help. There's instructions about how to go to your feast site and sign up and participate. And I hope those of you who enjoy that sort of thing and will look forward to it will participate. It's always a great blessing, especially at the Dells. I think I mentioned in past years that when I first went to the Dells in 1973, they had this orchestra and choir. And I thought, man, this is great. This is going to spread around the world. Well, it didn't spread around the world. but it still stays in the Dells, and it's there, and it's a real blessing. We appreciate it very much. It hasn't spread as much as I thought, but it's certainly a wonderful blessing to attend the feast there at the Dells with the music program. Today, I would share with you some things I hope will benefit especially the younger people in our congregation. And whenever you spend time thinking about young people, invariably your mind also goes to the future. At least mine does. Because you think young people, they're going to grow, they're going to develop, they have families and go on and do things and participate and help out in many ways in the church and do other things. And yet many older people have recognized, sometimes with sorrow, that the decisions they made when they were young had unexpected consequences later in life. They thought, well, I took this path down here way back then, and then all of a sudden, I see this result. And many remember, sometimes with sorrow, that they didn't always comprehend that when they made those decisions. They didn't see, well, if I go down this road, here's where it's likely to lead. I mean, you know, we're young, we don't know, we learn as we go. I don't know any parents, for instance, that don't look back to some extent and say, well, I wish I'd have handled something differently with the kids. Because you can be trained, child rearing, you know, you hear sermons on it or read books on it or do things, but yet it's on-hand experience. You're actually having to do it on-hand, and you'll learn as you go. And sometimes after 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years, you look back and you say, well, you know, if I'd have done this, I'd seen this or had it that way, this would have been a better way to deal with it. We all do that. We all see things later that we didn't see as we were going through it. Additionally, I think over the years, if you've lived very long on the planet, you've known of people who have endured years of hardship and suffering because of a poor start when they were young. Sometimes no fault of their own, but they just had a difficult situation. They had lack of education and leading to a low income and fewer opportunities. They didn't develop good work habits, like this guy in Deuteronomy 21. You wouldn't want him as an employee. Poor work habits, and also an inability to get along with other people. And that's more important than most people think, to learn how to get along with other people, living by certain principles that you don't compromise with. But to get along with people is a very important thing, and the earlier you learn it, the better it goes, just like most anything else. So when we think about young people, we tend to focus on the importance of making good choices when they're young. We'd like to see them make good choices, and ones that are valuable. Many people had the opportunity to spend time with Mr. Armstrong because of circumstances. Evelyn and I had the opportunity to spend more than the average amount of time. I was transferred to Brick and Wood in 1963 from Pasadena. Spent my final 2 years of college there, and Evelyn was traveling that summer and was invited by Mrs. Armstrong and Mr. Armstrong to attend Ambassador College and to go there in 1963, and she went home, and the Armstrongs and I were not too sure she was coming back, because this was a big change. Her whole life's going to change from school teacher. She had a contract. She had certain things that were difficult, and could she do it? But in her mind, she was going to do it, but she was struggling with it so that she gave off vibes that she wasn't going to do it. So that's when we started writing, and it was there. So Mr. Armstrong was involved in that, so I would talk to him about it, talk to Mrs. Armstrong about, you know, I wrote this and she wrote that and all that kind of thing. Additionally, when he was in Brick and Wood, which he loved, by that time, American society had gotten so that Mr. Armstrong wasn't at all at home in it. it had gotten so disrespectful and crass in many ways. but in England, they still had a certain respectfulness that he appreciated. So when he was over there, they had a little house on campus, very small little house, but nice one. He invited students over to counsel with him. He could call up Mr. Armstrong. Can I come over and talk? Yeah. So the British people, though, that was uncommon to them. You just didn't call up the Queen and drop in. But to me, an American with not a lot of training and not a lot of sense, I said, sure, I'll take him. So I went over, I'd go counsel with him, talk things over, I just had the opportunity to do that. And so did the others, but I think I took advantage of it more than others. So that led to Mr. and Mrs. Armstrong being involved in our marriage and our dating and all that. And at the graduation in 1965, he performed our wedding. And until his death, Evelyn and I had many opportunities to spend time with him. For a time, I worked with him personally, and as a matter of fact, I'll share with you, I lived in his house in Pasadena for 6 months because of unusual circumstances, and he just the way it was. He died in 1986 at 93 years old. Now, by the time you live in your 90s, you learn to see things that you don't see in your 30s and 40s and 50s. You get to see things in a broader light. When I think about Methuselah, I wonder, since he lived almost 1,000 years, I wonder how much wisdom he developed in that time. I presume a lot. But HWA had many opportunities to observe things that the younger people don't always recognize. I traveled with him once, a couple times, and I was once fill out the, you know, you go into a country, you fill out a form, birth date and all that. So I filled it out for him, and I had to scratch out 19 and put 18 because he was born in 1892. And, you know, that kind of struck me, born in 1892 on July 31st. And he lived a jam-packed life full of experience and learning. And think about the life he lived. He saw the world change from the age of the horse and buggy to the space age. 1892 was a long time ago. he said once that when he was 11 years old, which would have been about 1903, he was living in a farm in Iowa. And his father called to him and said, "Herbert, Hartbrett, come see the horseless carriage." So he ran to the window to see this new invention, a horseless carriage. Only this was a carriage pulled by a mule. His dad was giving him a hard time. But a carriage pulled by a mule, you don't see much anymore. You know, you don't see that around today. Cars were still pretty rare in that time. 1903 was the same year that the Wright brothers first flew at Kitty Hawk, South Carolina. He saw the development of the telephone, the photograph, and the phonograph. He saw radio and TV develop, one of the first ones on radio in 1934 with a regular broadcast. He saw TV develop. He did TV for a time. He saw the development of computers and satellites and space travel and people landing on the moon. What a difference from a cart pulled by a mule. He saw that all those things develop. And through the church and Ambassador College, he also came in contact with many young people who later got to be older people who had children and even grandchildren. He would see these generations. And you can learn from that. He mentioned that he noticed a trend in the lives of young people, and that trend will affect your life and your marriage. It will affect your children and even your children's, grandchildren's lives. Of course, I wouldn't have recognized this trend on my own. I hadn't lived long enough and probably still haven't. But after he stated it, I've seen so many examples of it that I know it's true. As I said, I wouldn't have come up with this on my own. But he saw it over those years. Mr. Armstrong noticed that those people who use the years between 16 and 25, he said, up to 16, it's only having fun. Not much serious. But from he said, the ones who use the years from 16 to 25, they apply themselves. They build good work habits. They learn to work with things. And they learn how to work in cooperation with other people. In those years, the study habits are formed. And they develop a habit of learning. And to learn the importance of learning and enjoy it. Enjoy learning. It benefits your whole life. To develop the ability to educate yourself on any topic. That's especially easy today. We're getting up to senior years, so I thought I need to learn how to do funerals and take care of these last years my life and Evelyn's life and plan for them. So the title of the book caught my attention, Death for Beginners. I really like the chapter on caskets. It's entitled Thinking Inside the Box. But this lady laid out in clear ways how to deal with these things, how to prepare for it. And it's freely available, easily available. And she lists websites and books and other reports that you can gain additional information to get more background on any topic you like in this area. So it's very educational. And now that I've read it once, I'm going back over it again to see if I figured out what it said the first time, to make sure I get it right. But you can learn to educate yourself on any topic. During those years, we develop our skills. The jobs of the future will go to people with the right skills. How many reports have we seen of so many jobs are available, but they don't have the people with skills to fill them? How many people have skills, but not the ones that needed for some of the jobs to be able to do that? Now, there are technical skills, which are important. There are organizational skills, and there are clerical skills, and there are teaching skills, and there are leadership skills. There's also, apart from leadership, or a part of leadership, are persuasive skills. Skills in being persuasive. You can help people toward worthy goals even if you're not the leader. That's one of the concepts of servant leadership. You can be a servant and still lead by example and by right advice and by giving suggestions and helping out in various ways. So Mr. Armstrong noticed that those who use those years between 16 and 25 are usually productive and successful for the rest of their lives. On the other hand, he noticed that those who don't make use of those important years, they don't learn to be responsible, they don't develop work skills and people skills, they don't take learning it seriously, are often, not always, but often unproductive and unsuccessful for the rest of their lives. Because those years are key to forming. They're important. As I mentioned, there are exceptions. And we've seen exceptions of people who start off on the wrong foot and get on the right foot. And we've seen people start off on the right foot and go off on the wrong foot. It happens both ways. It's just the way it is. Now, we are blessed to have young people in those important years of 16 to 25. But whether you realize it or not, you are developing habits, work habits, social habits, learning habits that are likely to stay with you the rest of your life. Those habits will affect your life, your marriage, your work, your children, and also your children's lives, because they'll grow up in a certain environment, and that environment will carry with them to some extent. For example, today, the United States unemployment is about 8.2%. Apparently, this last month, they've gone up more. It's gone up a little bit higher. I haven't seen a change in the stats, but it's about 8.2% overall. But they know for high school dropouts, it's much higher, perhaps two or three times higher. And they also know for college grads, it's usually about half the official unemployment rate, if those are college grads, they're about half. Now, it's thought and it's recognized and has been for many years that working to get an education usually pays off. Today, though, you have to be careful about not taking in too much debt. That's the big problem. They've changed the way they finance schools, and they actually encourage students to get into debt, which is kind of sad, I think, or at least some schools do. So in today's job market, many are finishing college with huge debt, but can't find a job in the area where they trained to, so they have to take a lower job, which makes it harder to pay off the debt. And it puts them into almost a serfdom. And they're trying to figure out ways to deal with that. And I like the old management dictum that I learned years ago. Inherent in the solution are the new problems. We try to fix something, and then we make new problems. Then we try to fix that, we make still new problems, and it starts going down the wrong road. I like that management dictum. Inherent in the solution are the new problems. Why is this important? Because we want our young people to be happy for the rest of their life. That's the basic reason. To be happy and for the rest of their life. And it's fair to ask you, are you happy? I asked that in a different context some years ago. Are you happy? Are you satisfied with your life? Well, it helps to ask, what makes people happy? What makes people feel satisfied with their life? What is it? About 8 years ago, I read a study. The study went for 20. So the study started 28 years ago, and I read about it 80. That they did a study to find out what makes people happy. And they rated it on a scale of 1 to 7. Number 1, or 1, I'm not satisfied at all with my life. Or number 7, I'm completely satisfied with my life. And they tried to measure it out in different areas of the world. Those on the Forbes 400 richest Americans average 5.8. Of the Forbes 400 richest Americans. Pavement dwellers in Calcutta. I mean, that's really poor. I mean, that's really, you know, they don't even have a house. They average 2.9. Now, those two stats kind of make sense. You can see where the Fortune 500, the Forbes 400, I've got to get my numbers right. That's easy to understand. However, consider this. The Inuit people of northern Greenland, they live a very simple life. In Greenland, which is misnamed, it should be Iceland, and Iceland should be Greenland. But they got it backwards. I guess it's a PR stunt to get tourists. They average 5.8 as well, the same as the people on the Forbes 400. That's amazing. And so do cattle herding Maasai tribesmen in Kenya. Now, in Kenya, they still have people living as they did for centuries in tribal situations. We visited once when we were in Nairobi and went out to a place with the Maasai where they still lived in huts and they still had their customs and they still do it the same way they always have. And they handled cattle, and this particular group had an unusual arrangement. They would take all the teenagers and form a new group in a group marriage. And then they would be a community, a little city on their own, mud huts and everything. And then they would be, you know, sometimes be in wars with other ones. But they just put them all over there. They're all kids. That's your family. And that's how it worked. But they had the same 5.8% satisfaction with their life, living in that circumstances. Exactly the same as the Forbes 400. And those in Calcutta living just one rung above those living on the pavement, they had small slums and very simple housing, they averaged 4.6, more than half, that they were basically accepting of their lives. A comparison of several studies concluded that wealth does not guarantee happiness. It doesn't guarantee happiness. In the last few decades, Americans have become more wealthy overall, but not more happy. And it's the same for Europe and Japan. In the last couple decades, they've become more wealthy, but not more happy. Wealth doesn't guarantee happiness. However, they also noticed another trend that you'll find interesting. And this should be easy to understand. Those people who said they were happy usually go on over time to become more wealthy. The happiness comes first, the wealth comes later. Consider that Mr. and Mrs. Grumpy, or Mr. and Mrs. Grumpy, are unlikely to receive promotion. People that are often dissatisfied with this and this. They express dissatisfaction with these various things. They're critical of workmates and supervisors. They feel put upon when asked to do a job and are thought to be complaining about something most of the time. Can you imagine this person getting promotions? How would that work? On the other hand, Mr. and Mrs. Cheerful are far more likely to have around. They do their job without complaint, and they usually finish what's expected. And they have it there. They think about their work, think of ways to improve it, ways to do it better, and they want to see the job done successfully. They're optimistic about it. They want to see the company grow. They smile. They're pleasant to be with. They're pleasant to work with. And things usually go better for them as a result. It's just the way life works. One of the surest ways to assure a happy future is to enjoy your work. Look at Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. You know this verse. Then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and to keep it. He gave him work to do. He built him a beautiful environment. I hope one day to see a recreation of the Garden of Eden. To see how the plants were put together, how the colors were, how the seasons, and how, you know, I just can't imagine that. We've been able to visit beautiful gardens all over the earth, and I'm waiting to see that one. I hope we get a chance to see that one. So it says, then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and to keep it. So he gave him work to do. In fact, it's astonishing. Adam Clark mentions on this, even in a state of innocence, he hadn't sinned yet, we cannot conceive it possible that man could have been happy if inactive. God gave him work to do, and his employment contributed to his happiness. For the structure of this body, as well as of his mind, plainly proves that he was never intended for a merely contemplative life. Sit there and staring at his navel. Kyle and DeLeach have a very interesting comment. In paradise, he was to dress the garden, for the earth was meant to be tended and cultivated by man, so that without human culture, plants and even the different varieties of corn degenerate and grow wild. Cultivation, therefore, preserved, and he has a parenthesis, keep, the divine plantation, not merely from injury on the part of any evil power, either penetrating into or already existing in the creation, but also from running wild through natural degeneracy. As nature was created for man, it was his vocation, not only to enable it by his work to make it subservient to himself, but also to raise it into the sphere of the spirit and further its glorification, to improve on it and build it and dress and keep it and enjoy the subsequent fruits. Now, while studying this passage, I learned something I hadn't known before. If you look at Genesis 2:8, it says, the Lord planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he'd formed. He put the man there. In Genesis 2:8, the word put used here, which is H7760, for those of you who like to keep track, the word hit means to put or place something. Just what we'd say in English, to put. They put him there. But he used a different word in 2:15. Then the Lord God took the man and put, it's a different word, put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and to dress it. The word that's used there is H3240, the definition from the Brooks Driver Compendium, I haven't got the name right. The word is, number one, to rest. 1A, to rest, settle down, and remain. 1-2, to repose, have rest, be quiet. In other words, he put him there to have a restful, pleasant life. God gave Adam a great blessing in the Garden of Eden. A place to work, to thrive, to rest, to settle down, and enjoy a quiet life. God knew that work was good for humans and would provide us with many benefits. Remember, Paul prays that, pray for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceful life in all godliness and reverence. Well, that's what God had in mind for Adam from the very beginning. Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. We'll begin in verse 3. Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and verse 3. Remember, Solomon was given wisdom and given great wealth, astonishing wealth. He says in Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 3, I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guarding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold of folly that I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their life. What's a good way to live? I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had great possessions of herds and flocks than all those in Jerusalem before me. I gathered for myself silver and gold for special and the special treasure of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers. I had the delights of the sons of men and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward for my labor. Then I looked at the works that my hands had made, and the labor which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping after the wind. There was no profit under the sun. He had done all these things, and then felt very empty. Verse 20, same chapter 2. Therefore I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor which I had toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom and knowledge and skill. Notice that. A man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. Yet he must leave his heritage or his, what's the marginal word there? They got a different word for it. Heritage gives up a wrong connotation, to a man who has not labored for it. This also is a vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. You lie awake at night thinking, I got to get this done. I got to get that done. Oh, I forgot this. Or, you know, all the things we do. This also is vanity. Verse 24. Nothing is better for a man that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. God's hand designed it that way. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment more than I? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. But to a sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting. They may give it to him who is good before God. This also is a vanity and grasping for the wind. It's what does man take for all the benefits of his work? Solomon concluded that the number one thing is to enjoy your work. And he said also eat and drink. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 3, beginning in verse 9. What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in his time. He's put eternity in their hearts, except no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. He's put a desire to live in our hearts. And yet, we don't know what God's doing. He didn't hear the gospel, you've got to remember. Verse 12, I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labor. It's the gift of God. It's the gift of God. Verse 22, so I perceive that nothing is better than a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage, or his portion, I think the word is. For who can bring to him, who can bring him to see what will happen after him? Now, if you wouldn't mind going to chapter 5, and we'll start in verse 10. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 10. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. He who loves abundance will increase. This also is vanity. You never heard of a rich man saying, I've had enough, I'm done, I don't want to do anything. I'm going to sit here and live. Doesn't tend to go that way. When goods increase, they increase and eat them. You got more people to feed. So what profit have the owners thereof except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune, or the margin says bad business is literally. They're riches and then they disappear. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. No baby was born with anything in his hand. As he comes from his mother womb, naked shall he return to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor which he has carried, which he may carry away in his hand. And this is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All his days he eats in darkness. He tries to keep the cost down. And he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all their labor which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him. For that's his heritage is the word there. Forget the other one. His portion. And to every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it. You ever see a really rich person who can't digest their food? Who can't eat because of their sickness or they've got difficulty? What a difficult situation that is. And for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him the power to eat of it, to receive his portion and rejoice with his labor, for it's the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly of the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. You know, it's really interesting. Possessing things doesn't bring happiness. But by producing things and maintaining things and fixing things and solving difficult problems and sharing with others is a delight. In other words, the work is the joy. Having it is not. Learning things, discovering things, teaching things can produce great joy and satisfaction. Helping others solve problems, repairing a car, structural engineering or health problems, dealing with that and relationship difficulties. Being able to help people is joyful. Just owning things isn't. You know, I've heard over the years many people moan about paperwork. That's not smart. Because today, I can't imagine a job that doesn't involve some paperwork. Humanly, I find paperwork boring. I'll acknowledge it. But I've had to do it so much that I've developed a pattern so that I make it enjoyable. Actually, I get it done. And that's my secret. I do almost my paperwork as fast as I can. I do it as quickly. My car record is up to date to today. Tomorrow, my ministerial report will have the report on it, the sermon title, who gave it, and you know that sort of thing, the attendance that goes into Pasadena. And I try to get my church reports ready, monthly reports, and then I do my expense report on the first day of the month. I love getting it done and getting it behind me. That's the joy. And finish it, and it's done. Fine. So my paperwork I consider almost fun because I keep it up to date. Proverbs 22:29, I'll just read it to you. He said, do you see a man skilled in his work? a man skilled in his work. He works, he's skilled. He will serve before kings. He will not serve before obscure men. That's the NIV. Serving before obscure men has its benefits. We all do that, and we've all done that. But it's a great honor and a pleasure to serve before kings. It's a great blessing to be able to contribute, that your work contributes, your work benefits. Now, Solomon isn't the only one who recognized that enjoying your work brings happiness. Let's go to Acts chapter 20. Paul had been called out to carry the gospel into non-Israelite areas, but he tried to do it as Urban Armstrong did. They had the same policy, though it's not always recognized, that when Paul would go out and preach the gospel, he wouldn't charge anybody for it. He wouldn't say, now, you know, to the new people. Presumably, when they became part, and of course they were in the synagogue, so they knew how God financed things, they would of themselves volunteer to help out, which they did, and he records that in various places. But when he went in to preach, he didn't say anything about that. And he worked as a tent maker to earn his way. Let's look at Acts chapter 20, verse 32. He said, this is when he got an elders together at Ephesus, and he was going to have an elders meeting before he went off to Jerusalem. He said, so now, brethren, Acts 20, 32, I commend you to God and to the word of his grace, which is able to build you up and give you an inheritance among all those who are sanctified. I have coveted no one's silver or gold or apparel. Samuel, when he finished up and they wanted a king, he said, I'm a witness here. I haven't taken anything from you. I haven't done anything that way. And Paul could say the same thing. I have coveted no one's silver or gold or apparel. Yes, you yourselves know that these hands have provided for my necessities and for those who are with me. He earned enough to be able to support his team. I have shown you in every way by laboring like this that you must support the weak. He set an example. And to remember the words of the Lord Jesus that he said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. So he encouraged the elders there to be giving elders, to do their work and benefit the flock. And, of course, none of those elders were full-time as we would. We have a total different situation today, but they were like what we call local church elders. He said, therefore, I've shown you in every way, by laboring like this, that you must support the weak and remember the words of the Lord Jesus, it's more blessed to give than to receive. It's interesting, you won't find that in the gospel, that phrase. Paul quotes Jesus, but it's not quoted anyplace else. But Jesus did talk to him often, so I'm sure he got it right. Ephesians chapter 2, Ephesians chapter 4, sorry. Paul, writing to the Ephesian brethren, gives a little checklist toward the end of things to do. He has six sayings here at the end of chapter 4. And he says in verse 28, Ephesians 4:28, let him who stole steal no more, or steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands, what is good, that he may have something to give to him who has need. That the thief not only stops stealing, he starts becoming a benefactor. He starts actually contributing to help other people. That's quite a change. That's what Paul recommended. Look at 1 Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 11 and 12. Breaking into the paragraph, he said, he's talking about brotherly love, and then he said that you also may aspire to lead a quiet life and to mind your own business. We all need to be reminded of that from time to time, and to work with your own hands as we commanded you, and that you may walk properly toward those who are outside, and that you may lack nothing. So you do a good job, you work, and you lack nothing. He mentioned that again to the Thessalonians in chapter 3, 2 Thessalonians, chapter 3. Apparently they had a problem with that in Thessalonica, beginning in verse 6, 2 Thessalonians 3:6. But we commend you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly and not according to the tradition which you've received from us, or which he received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you. How were they not disorderly? And nor did we take anyone's bread free of charge, but worked with labor and toil night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you. Not because we do not have the authority, he certainly did, but to make ourselves an example of how you ought to follow us. For even when we were with you, we commanded you this, saying, if anyone will not work, now it's different from cannot work, but if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. That seems a fair trade. For we hear that there are some who among you who, in a disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies. And to those who are such, we command and exhort through our Lord Jesus Christ that they work in quietness and eat their own bread. But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary in doing good. And he goes on to talk about that from there others. When our country began, we had people who were very concerned about work. Benjamin Franklin said, work as if you were to live 100 years and pray as if you'd die tomorrow. He also said they had developed some welfare laws, which the early fathers of the country didn't believe in, Ben Franklin among them. He said, repeal that welfare law and you will soon see a change in their manners. 6 days shall you labor, though one of the old commandments, long treated as out of date, will again be looked upon as a respectable precept. Industry will increase, and with it plenty among the lower people. Their circumstances will mend, and more will be done for their happiness by inuring them or make them accustomed to provide for themselves than could be done by dividing all your estates among them. They do better by learning to work and provide it, and it benefits everybody. This seems very topical, although he's an early American. Ebenezer Elliott observed, who is a communist? One who has yearnings for equal divisions of unequal earnings. Who's a communist? One who has yearnings for equal division of unequal yearnings. Now, having said all of that, on the other hand, we have to be balanced in our work and not workaholics. Able to back away from our work for a while, take a break, recharge the batteries. And it's important also to separate the important from the urgent. Separate those two. Not everything that's urgent is important. And not everything that's important is urgent, so it tends to get pushed back. Some things are important but not urgent, so they tend to be postponed. That's got to be careful. We must see the proper perspective. Those who have the right balance of work and rest and refreshment and all that will be best in the long run. I'll mention to you that the Europeans and other countries think most Americans work too much. They think we're all workaholics. They think we don't know how to enjoy a quiet meal with friends, that we're always racing and charging someplace. And there's some truth to that. For Europeans, the meal with friends could take a whole evening. When I first went to Britain, I tried to fight that. They won. They won. The meal takes a whole evening. They have various courses, and you talk, and you fellowship, and you go back and forth, and you go. It goes a little. Then it's followed by dessert, coffee, cheese, fruit, port. Some have a cigar, and by lively conversation in a different room. You don't have your dessert where you had the meal. You go in a different room. At least you used to. And you have those other things there, talk and fellowship, the whole evening. It's wonderful when you got the time to do it. But they picture Americans at a fast food drive-up, ready to grab something to drive off and go do something else. that seems uncivilized to them. To avoid burnout and other negative results, we all need regular breaks and quiet dinners with family and friends. An uplifting conversation is wonderful. By the way, the Chinese, when you eat, it's not how you eat your food. You know, we're so concerned. Now, you hold your fork this way, and you do it that way. They don't worry about that. They take their chopsticks, put the bowl up, boop, 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 boop. But for them, good manners at a meal is what you say. That you say pleasant things. That you say uplifting things. I was once with the Chinese brethren and in Hong Kong, and these changes were being introduced, you know. And they wanted to go out for a meal. So we went out for a meal, and usually rice is the last course. And so we go through all the meals. Everything's wonderful. Everything's pleasant. We had the rice. The tea was there, and they said, "Now, about these changes." The meal was over. You can talk about stuff. But while the meal was there, you keep it pleasant, which they feel helps aid digestion and beneficial in many ways. And I think there's some truth to that. As I mentioned earlier, we talk about youth and we start thinking about the future. We think about what it's going to hold for them and how it's going to go. And we want them to have a wonderful future and avoid some of the mistakes that we made or we've seen others make. The choices young people make today will have a significant impact in the years to come. And I say a really significant impact. We all hope our young people make sound choices today, especially career choices, which will lead to happiness and satisfaction and prosperity in the years to come.